Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And our top story today takes us once again to Syria, the collapse of the Assad family regime after more than 50 years and the transition to a new government, whatever form that might take. As well as celebrations, there is also understandably anger towards the former president and his security apparatus, which meted out so much cruelty to Syrians over the decades. And to Bashar al-Assad's father, who ruled with just as much ruthlessness and created the secret police and their network of prisons that tortured and killed the regime's opponents. Well, today, rebel fighters broke into Hafez al-Assad's tomb in the family's hometown in the coastal province of Latakia. Images show a coffin and parts of the grand mausoleum on fire. This man described what he'd seen.
We're at the tomb of Hafez al-Assad. We came and saw it burnt and destroyed by the people of his village because he starved them, because they hated him, and because he destroyed us. He displaced them and displaced us.
Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is in Damascus. So, fury towards the Assads, but what about their henchmen? Are there signs of people now wanting to take revenge?
Yes, extraordinary scenes that you've just been talking about, James, in Gardaha, at the coastal the family ancestral stronghold. And I was in Gardaha several years ago and actually got permission to visit that mausoleum. It took a lot of persuasion. And in fact, the government minder hovered very carefully as we went through this vast grey stone mausoleum, not just of Bashar al-Assad, but his wife Anissa and Basil, the brother of Bashar al-Assad, who was actually the man who was meant to take over from Hafez al-Assad. But the government minder was so worried that we would say something disrespectful, would somehow demean the memory of the leader. That's how much, how reverential the whole atmosphere was. And to see it now going up in flames is a measure of the passions that really are running very, very high here. And even though the new leadership is trying to send this signal that it wants to establish peace and stability, that there's a general amnesty, there is every day reports of summary executions, reports of tracking down members of the Shabiha, a shadowy organization blamed for so many massacres here. They want to take revenge, and although they do say they're going to put people on trial, they're not waiting for the trial. They're dealing with them in the same way that they were dealt with for decades.
And Lise, what about the city around you? Is it functioning? Are people now starting to go back to work, to school, things like that?
Yeah, these are the essence of momentous times like this. You look for what are the big visions, what kind of a new governance is emerging, but you also look at the details of daily life. Are the buses running on time? Is the traffic flowing? Are the lights on during the night? And little by little, we see that the city is resuming its normal rhythms. More shops are opening up, and it's such an extraordinary moment, just because every time I used to come to Syria, I always left feeling that I knew what it felt like, insofar as we can, the heavy hand of the state here, how repressive it was. And extraordinary to see Syrians grabbing this newfound freedom that they've never tasted before to speak their mind. So when we were in the old city, we went into the exquisite courtyard of the Umayyad Mosque, the Grand Mosque of Damascus, and I met an English teacher there, and I asked her to tell me about her feelings and tell me who she was.
My name is Rinas Khalil.
And how do you describe this moment, its importance for you?
Like, it's an amazing moment. Actually, first we were so nervous, we couldn't believe it. Like, maybe it's a dream, but actually, because it's been a nightmare for us for all these years, but now it came true, and it's a new day for us. It's a new morning for us. Like, when the war started, I was 11 years old, and so I grew up with the war, in the war. So I couldn't believe that maybe someday there going to be a new day, a beautiful day. But thanks God it happened.
It's only the third day, so it's early days. Yes. What are you hoping from the new leadership?
Actually, I'm hoping just to be a free Syria. Actually, it's a free Syria, not like it's going to be a new... like someone like the previous president. I don't want to be like him. Huh? We want someone who is from us and with us and work for us, only for us, not work for himself.
That was English teacher Rinas Khalil talking to our chief international correspondent Lise Doucette in Damascus. Well, what about that question of justice or retribution for those who carried out the Assad regime's orders? Minel Alami is a jihadist media specialist with BBC Monitoring. Has she seen evidence of people taking matters into their own hands?
Yes, on social media as well as on Telegram, where there's a lot of action, we have seen clips and images emerge. We haven't been able to independently verify them, but they do claim to show the summary execution of individuals accused of having been involved in atrocities and human rights violations while they were with the government of Bashar al-Assad, whether they were in the army or what they call what is known in Syria as Shabiha, which is kind of like the henchmen or pro-government militia. So there have been clips showing that in various provinces, Hama, Idlib, Latakia, but we haven't been able to verify the individuals in these videos.
And what about the main rebel group, HTS? I mean, what is their position on this at the moment?
Well, when they first arrived, you know, early days when they captured Damascus, there was a very strong message of reassurance, including for the Alawites, which is the minority sect of Bashar al-Assad, as well as members of the former government and the army, the armed forces. So on the 9th of December, the head of HTS, Jawlani, using his real name, Ahmed al-Shara, issued a statement, a decree saying that there will be amnesty, including all soldiers, conscripts, members of the armed forces who were not involved in any atrocities. And he urged people not to exact any revenge or take matters into their own hand. And the same for the Alawite community. He said, you know, there should be no retribution. There was a backlash on Telegram amongst hardline Islamists the following day saying, you know, this is not in line with Sharia, but also, you know, this is not right for the people who suffered under Bashar al-Assad. And they were actually calling for vigilante-style retribution in defiance of HTS's orders. And they said, actually, some of them, you know, prominent figures online, they said, you should actually take revenge. However, make sure not to publicize it. Do not post it on social media. Do not mutilate the bodies. But people do have the right to do that. The following day, HTS's leadership issued a follow-up statement saying they will punish officials, government officials, and senior military officials who have been involved in atrocities, if that is proven. But they suggested that this will be a legal process rather than kind of people taking matters into their own hands. Yeah. And some of the government's clerics said, the HTS clerics said, we want to make sure that this doesn't happen. Otherwise, the country will fall into civil war again if people start taking revenge.
Minel Alami of BBC Monitoring. Another of the big questions now that the Assad regime has collapsed is what happens to Syria's Kurdish population, numbering about 2.5 million and living in the north of the country along the border with Turkey. Turkey regards them as a threat, and the Kurdish militia in Syria, the SDF, as an ally of its sworn enemy, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. But the SDF is an ally of the United States, helping America defeat IS a few years ago. There are still about 900 US troops based in Syria. I've been talking to Aras Yusuf, a research associate at the Kurdish Peace Institute think tank based in Qamishli in Syria's Kurdish region. First of all, how have people there been reacting to Bashar al-Assad's ousting?
Basically, they are happy that a regime of 50 years have failed. It was a dictator that suppressed Syrian people in general and Kurdish people particularly. So that's a relief. But in general, Kurdish people, they have this awareness that it's not about the failure of regime only, the Assad regime. It's about what will happen after this failure. What will be the situation of Kurds, their future in a new Syria?
And have Syria's Kurds had any assurances from the main rebel group, for example, HTS, that Kurds will be welcome in an interim government and indeed whatever follows after that?
Until now, we didn't hear anything on formal channels or platforms. And as we could see, the new government made by the HTS didn't include any people from other minorities like Christians, Kurds. It's not clear in the future if they will make any changes about it, but we didn't hear any assurance or promises or even suggestions by them.
And what about the fact that HTS seems to be backed by Turkey, and Turkey for a long time has been very hostile to the Kurds? Do people where you are worry about that?
Of course, the main threat of Kurds people in Syria is Turkey. Turkey support the SNA.
That's the Syrian National Army, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So the main threats are from these factions and Turkey itself. Turkey looks for any opportunity to make any new invasions of northeast Syria or to take over new parts of it.
Yes, and there have already been clashes, haven't there, between the Kurdish militia and that Syrian National Army backed by Turkey. That's been happening, hasn't it, in the past 2 weeks?
Yes, in Manbij, clashes in Manbij and Shilling and Kobani.
The Kurds' biggest supporter has been the United States, and there are still, nearly 900 US troops supporting the Kurdish militia. Donald Trump says he wants to pull those troops out. How do you feel about that?
Once the results were announced that Trump has become the president, of course, the Kurdish people were a little bit disappointed. They predicted it, that he would be the president, and they were afraid what will be the consequences of becoming president again after he withdrew the troops in 2019 and led to invasion of Sarikania. So Kurdish people were afraid of a similar scenario in northeast Syria.
It sounds like there is a great deal of worry and uncertainty at the moment.
Yes. And especially that the events that happened in Manbij and the Turkish shelling on Kobani were right after the regime failure, that increased the fear and anxiety amongst Kurdish people.
And that was Aras Youssef, a research associate at the Kurdish Peace Institute. That's a think tank in Syria's Kurdish region. We will be returning to what's happening in Syria a little later in the programme. We're going to be hearing from our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, and also hearing from someone who fled the Assad regime just over a decade ago. Will he now return, given that the rebels are asking people to come back and help rebuild the country? That's coming up in just over 15 minutes here on NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Also coming up later, a Netflix series of the great magic realist novel 100 Years of Solitude has faced some criticism as its author, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, never wanted to see it adapted for the screen. But series director Alex Garcia Lopez tells us that even the late Colombian author struggled with the story's narrative.
Gabo himself said, a few times that he tried to tell this story many times and he could never find the angle. He could never sort of find the execution, the approach, until he realized that he needed to tell the 100 Solitude in the same way that his grandmother would tell him these cuentos, these stories.
That's coming up in half an hour. One other headline this hour. Saudi Arabia has officially been chosen to host the 2034 Men's Football World Cup, despite criticism of its record on human rights and the environment. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Let's turn to Afghanistan now and a suicide bombing that's killed the country's refugee minister Khalil Haqqani as he was leaving his office in Kabul along with six others. He is the most senior member of the Taliban government to die in an attack since the group came back to power 3 years ago. He is also a member of one of Afghanistan's most powerful families. I asked the Afghan journalist Bilal Sawari if anyone had claimed responsibility for the attack.
Daesh has said that it was their work that they had carried out the assassination, which is a brazen security failure. There are quite credible reports that the attacker posed as someone who had a broken arm, and that he was detected at a scanner with some sort of metal being detected, and he said that he just simply wanted to greet the minister. The irony here is that the Haqqani network introduced suicide attacks in Afghanistan along with Al-Qaeda, with the group. They have a generational, historical, and ideological relationship. And today they are the victim of that tactic. However, there is a history of quite a lot of differences between Mr. Khalil Haqqani and Mullah Biradar, who's a senior figure from the Kandahari faction. There was a famous fist fight. There was gunfire, and thermoses and teacups were thrown at each other when the Taliban first came into power, after a verbal clash turned into physical fight inside the Taliban cabinet meeting at the time.
How did Khalil Haqqani fit into that Haqqani family or network?
Well, to Sirajuddin Haqqani, who's the interior minister and leader of the Haqqani network, Khalil was a father figure after the elder Haqqani died. This is a figure who was involved for quite a bit in many different wars and conflicts, starting from the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. And he was quite a colorful character as well. I mean, there are reports that he was a heavy drinker, and he always carried his pistol and never hidden his love for M4 American rifle, which he carried. So the irony is that a minister who was so well protected, came from a very powerful faction of the Taliban, always carried a gun, could not actually, protect his own life. And this goes against the very popular narrative that the Taliban would like everyone to believe, that there's no security threat, that everything is safe in Afghanistan, is perfectly secure.
But just briefly, I mean, is it possible then that this was sort of factional fighting within the Taliban?
Well, one cannot rule that element, especially when Sirajuddin Haqqani has been castigating Mullah Hebatullah Akhundzada, and it is hardly a secret that Hebatullah in Kandahar has limited the Haqqani's power and influence. And one also has to mention that two cabinet positions were offered to the Haqqanis. One was taken by his nephew as the interior minister, and the second was taken by him. So Sirajuddin preferred his uncle rather than many of his brothers. And that kind of shows you what a big blow that is to the Haqqani family, because they have been losing a lot of their family members as well.
That was the Afghan journalist Bilal Sawari. According to a UN report published today, the number of victims of human trafficking being detected around the world has risen by 25% compared to pre-pandemic levels. The majority of these are women and girls who are mostly trafficked for the purpose of sexual exploitation, and many of them come to Europe via Spain. The BBC 100 Women team has followed one elite unit of police detectives as they rescue trafficked women and help them rebuild their lives. The BBC's Blanca Munoz has this report.
It all starts with a friendly voice on the phone, offering you an opportunity when you need it the most. When you realize what's going on, it's too late. Life will never be the same. For Victoria, this moment came when she first saw the room where she would spend the next 3 years. It was the metal lock on the door that made her shiver.
I was shocked. I started to cry and begged her to let me go.
The trafficker who had lured Victoria to Spain from Colombia responded with two simple words: no way. Spain is both a transit country and often the final destination for thousands of victims, mainly from Latin America and Africa, who are trafficked into Europe. Instead of starting her promised job as a cleaner, Victoria was immediately forced into prostitution.
I had to sleep with my makeup on, and you always had to be in your underwear, ready for any customer who will arrive.
Victoria lived with the fear that no one would come to save her. An elite team of mainly female investigators was already on her trafficker's trail. At a secret location in the middle of the night, the police is preparing to raid a property where a gang is suspected to hide their victims. Cristina is part of an elite unit of Guardia Civil detectives who fight organized crime and rescue trafficked victims.
It's minutes, seconds even, before you can enter the property, but it feels like an eternity.
The team's investigation shows that sex trafficking has gone farther underground after the pandemic, with most victims now kept in private apartments supplied by criminal gangs. The state of these flats affects even experienced investigators like Cristina.
You are ready to throw away the clothes you wear during a raid, as you won't be able to wash the smell off. It's so distressing, and the stench often makes you sick.
Her deputy, Lydia, agrees.
When you go inside these flats and see the conditions in which victims had to work and live for so long, it's terrifying.
It was Cristina and Lydia's team who rescued Victoria from one of these flats a few years ago. We can't give details of her rescue, because as a protected witness, we need to conceal her identity. But Victoria remembers it was a sunny morning.
I look at them, hug them, and cried. They offered to take me to a safe place where I could be free without fear.
The police investigation is over, but the officers who rescued Victoria continue to support her. Today is her birthday, so the team is meeting her with a cake to celebrate. Cristina, again.
We do not only work on a case so it makes it to court. We believe in a social and humanitarian process that can restore hope in victims' lives so they can truly recover and live passionately again.
This unit also helped to bring Victoria's children over from Colombia safely after her traffickers had threatened to hurt them.
The unit gave me another chance not only to live, but to heal and hug my children again. I go out on the street and breathe, and I say, my God, thank you, I'm alive. I feel free, and that's the best feeling.
She asks our team to call her Victoria, because it means victory in Spanish. Cristina says she marvels at her resilience.
You want to help them, and yet they are so strong that they want to help others too. And I think, my goodness, there is so much inner power, such bravery in you.
A report by the BBC's Blanca Muñoz for the BBC's 100 Women season currently running. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. Lots more coming up in the second half of the programme. Welcome back to NewsHour. Time to talk about whales, and specifically male humpback whales, which are known for mating songs like this. Researchers say one humpback whale appears to have made one of the longest and most unusual migrations ever recorded. He was first spotted in 2017 in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Colombia. He then popped up several years later near the Tanzanian island of Zanzibar in the Indian Ocean, a distance of at least 13,000 kilometres. That's more than 8,000 miles. Well, for more, my colleague Celia Hatton's been speaking to Ekaterina Kalashnikova of the Tanzania Cetaceans Programme. Celia began by asking her how unusual this kind of journey was for a humpback whale.
This species is highly migratory, but they are quite loyal to the initial breeding grounds and the feeding grounds. So they do indeed cover a huge amount of kilometers. They cover thousands of kilometers on one-way migration, moving in between the breeding areas and the foraging areas, but they do not normally change their ocean basins. And this particular individual not only went to completely different breeding grounds, but also relocated from the East Pacific and finally arriving to the Western Indian Ocean. So this is longitudinal movement is rather unusual for these otherwise highly migratory species.
So he visited a few different breeding grounds. Is he sort of like the equivalent of a humpback whale Casanova?
It is, yes. And the different breeding grounds are well defined for different populations. But the exchange between such a far away breeding grounds, that's really, really unusual. And when we have seen the result, automatic recognition of the happy whale, we couldn't believe our eyes. We said there is an error. And then we had to look without this platform. It wouldn't have crossed our mind to cross-check our Tanzanian catalog with Colombian catalog because the populations are so far away and there was no that knowledge that this even was possible. So that was because of this fantastic technology that is now available to anyone, basically. We were able to identify that lone traveler.
Any idea why this whale might have traveled so far? Does it have anything to do with climate change, for example?
Climate change might play a role, yes, because it's been demonstrated by other research that global climatic changes do affect the krill mass, biomass, and distribution in the foraging areas in the Southern Sea, which may in turn force the animals to different foraging grounds in the still same area, but going further. He probably followed the other animals from different populations and ended up in different breeding grounds.
And last year, Katerina, you've been focusing on the movements of this whale. Have you named him?
We haven't yet, but probably we should. And if I wanted to pick a name for him, I would say we could name him Skull because of the pigmentation pattern that is looking very much like a skull, the ventral side of his tail. Even his dorsal fin is quite distinctive. And we also used the photographs of the dorsal fin to confirm that that's exactly the same individual that has been seen in Colombia and in Tanzania.
That was Ekaterina Kalashnikova. This is the BBC World Service in London. You're listening to NewsHour and I'm James Menendez. Let's return to Syria now because we're going to hear from the BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen, who's been in and out of the country for decades. And he's back now, returning just hours after the demise of the Assad regime. For the first time in many years, he says it's a place where people can talk openly and be heard by the outside world.
We're just going past a very tattered, shot-up checkpoint.
There's still a bit of a portrait of Bashar al-Assad and his father, and there are men in civilian clothes or bits of uniform, rebels, in charge now, waving us through, shaking hands with the driver, all very happy, thumbs up. I'm starting to realise fully that the regime has gone. I mean, I kind of knew it, but having been here so many times when the place was essentially under the jackboot of the Assad family, it's quite a scene.
Tamam.
It's Remy Martin XF. That's like $200 a bottle. Well, at the Syrian border terminal, there was a really fancy duty-free shop, and I'm in it now. The steel shutter has been ripped up. There's massive amount of debris outside. And initially, I thought it was theft, or there may have been a bit of that, but there are a lot of broken bottles of very expensive spirits, whiskey, fancy brandies and things like that. So this may have been Islamists getting rid of alcohol, which they don't agree with. And actually, if I smell the smell here in the lobby of the building, it absolutely stinks of alcohol. So they've been just, I think, opening the bottles and emptying them. So I've come to an area called Meze 86, and I wanted to come back here because in all the years of the regime, this was one of the hot spots of loyalty to the Assad family. Why? Because a majority of the people who lived around here were from their own Alawite community, and it was families supported by men basically who carried guns for the regime, who were in the military, who were in one of the many intelligence agencies much feared by the wider population. And the atmosphere has changed. The Assad posters have gone. I'm near the rubbish heap. There are army boots on it, there are uniforms, there's a flak jacket, all of them chucked away. And I've been talking to a woman here called Safa al-Safadi, who she tells me her neighbours, her former neighbours, they're not here anymore.
They all left. I live
on top of this building. I can see from the top. They all left when the FSA arrived. They left.
How's life now with without Assad?
Tamam, حلوة.
Yeah, beautiful.
Beautiful, yes. Beautiful.
Why beautiful?
Life without Assad is beautiful, but we don't feel enough safe yet. We need to be more safe.
What would you like to have to make you feel safer?
I just need the things to quiet down. The children are afraid from all those arms, bullets in the air, and that's it.
Right now, Damascus seems like a calm city. Let's hope it stays that way. We've stopped for a bite to eat at a shawarma takeaway, which for years and years I've been coming to when I've been here. And the guys here say that they're actually the first day they've been back. They were closed for a couple of days, but now they're here and they're doing business. It's a sign, I guess, of some return to normalcy. Why did you decide to reopen today? You've been closed for a couple of days.
We opened the shop because we wanted our lives back. We are happy that our country is safe again.
What about the future? Are you feeling positive or are you a bit worried?
I'm very optimistic. Very optimistic. We couldn't express ourselves openly before. The country was full of injustice and oppression. That's over now.
The fire brigade have come, and there's a lot of smoke coming from the building, which is shuttered. What's happened here is that this is a mobile phone shop that was looted a couple of days ago. I can see the broken glass. And today, someone has got in there and has set a fire and is trying to burn it down. Why did they hate this place so much? Well, it's called Emma Tel Po. It's named after Asma al-Assad, the wife of Bashar. Emma was, I think, the name she was known as when she was growing up and going to school in England. And they want to get rid of it. Any connection with the family, it's got to go. So I've been driving around for a couple of hours, and what are my impressions? Well, this is a city that feels like it's coming back to life. I'm told that yesterday shops were shut, the streets were empty. Well, they're open today and there are people around. Another conclusion, people are willing to talk in a way that it just wasn't possible in all the visits I made here during the many years of the Assads. There's a sense of optimism, I think, among people, but also a realization that it's not necessarily going to be easy. They know their history. They know the region. They realize that bad things can happen and often do. But for now, for today, oh, I've seen a lot of people smiling and laughing, and you didn't always get that when you stuck a microphone in their face here in Damascus in the days of the Assad family.
Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen in Syria. Well, the new interim government there, led by the rebel group HTS, has urged Syrians who fled the country because of the civil war to come back to help rebuild. More than 6 million Syrians left in the past few years, mostly to settle in Europe. Among them, Ayman al-Hussein, who left the northern city of Manbij in 2012 as a teenager with his dad, brother and sister. He ended up in the UK, where he was granted asylum. He now lives in London with his British partner. First of all, what made him leave Syria?
When the revolution started, we've heard about the kids who were tortured in the city of Daraa by Assad regime. We all went out to protest, and the Assad regime was super quick to come and catch people. So I was arrested twice, once for 2 days and the second time for 14 days. They consider myself one of the lucky ones because I wasn't tortured, but I was beaten up and I was made to sign papers that say that I was a terrorist. Luckily, we were freed the second time by the people of the city who was around at the police station. Otherwise, I would have probably ended up in Sidnaya prison or something like that. After that, there was a lot of Assad bombing on the city, killing hundreds of civilians. And there was this day, specifically a day before Eid, when they bombed the square of the city of Manbij, and I was at the same spot where the bombshell landed 20 seconds before that, and I was really close to, you know, dying, basically. And it was a moment of realization for the whole family that it's time to leave, and we all left.
And you went to Turkey?
We went to Turkey, and we were kind of back and forth between Turkey and Syria for the first month. But as things got worse in Syria, we decided to stay in Turkey until things get better. Unfortunately, obviously, they didn't. And my family said, maybe you should stay in Turkey and maybe find a university and study. And hopefully by the time you finish, things will get better in Syria. Obviously, that didn't happen. When I finished studying, ISIS was in Manbij and a lot of areas in Syria, and in the other areas as well, Assad was butchering everyone. So going back wasn't really an option. Obviously, being on the wanted list by Assad, not only for being in prison, but also any young man in Syria basically are, you know, forced to go to military service and carry a gun. And a lot of Syrians that you see flee in Syria didn't want to join the military service and start killing people.
So you decided to try to get to the UK, and you had quite a journey, didn't you?
I actually got to the UK not on a small boat. I got to the UK inside a suitcase on a coach that was going from Paris to London. That was after trying everything else. It was a completely stupid idea and very dangerous. I almost suffocated in that suitcase.
Yeah. Gosh. But you came to the UK, what, because you had members of your family in Manchester?
So yeah,
is that
I
right?
have two family members in Manchester, and I spoke English, and I didn't really want to start again.
But you have full refugee status now. You can stay in the UK for as long as you want. And I'm going to ask you about whether you would consider going back to Syria in a moment. But I mean, just give us a sense, first of all, of your reaction this week to what's been happening and the fall of Assad and his flight to Moscow.
I really feel gutted that he didn't get caught. I feel like justice needs to be served, and I don't think he should get away with it. We felt very happy for the first day. I would have like 5 minutes of crying with happiness and 5 minutes of crying with sadness after we've seen the images from the prisons and the horrible stories that we heard about those who are coming out of prisons. So our happiness was really short-lived after what we've seen. And we're still in shock. I actually still can't believe that he's gone.
The main rebel group, HTS, says, you know, it wants Syrians abroad to come back, people like yourself. Would you go back? Have you thought about that yet?
I've been in the UK 8 years. I left Syria when I was 18. I'm 30 now. I also have a British partner, so things are kind of more complicated now. She's from Wales. But I would definitely would love to go back there. What I would really, really love to do is one day take all my friends from the UK to Syria and show them around. But also, we're all thinking about how we can build Syria again. There's a lot of work that needs to be done before people can go back. The infrastructure in Syria is absolutely gone. The education system is fully corrupt. It has to change. You know, there are a lot of sanctions on Syria still that hasn't been lifted. More than 1 million Syrians are displaced inside Syria. And if you think about all the people who would go back, the 7 million from outside Syria, there's literally nowhere for them to be. But I am sure a lot of people will be going back. We are seeing already a lot of people starting to chat about what everyone can do to get the country back on its feet. It's a dream come true. It's something we're not used to. We've never had democracy.
Do you think that's what's going to happen? It is going to be a democratic country, or are you worried about all these competing factions, powers fighting over the territory?
You know, I'm not worried about, you know, Al-Qaeda and all these things. I believe in the Syrian people, and I believe that we are going to have a diverse and very respectful nation for all Syrians, Arab, Kurds, Christians, and everyone else. Only unity is going to bring the country back.
And that was Ayman al-Hussein speaking to me a little earlier. You're listening to NewsHour.
This is James Menendez with NewsHour, live from the BBC.
Carguen! Apunten!
¡Viva la revolución!
¡Fuego!
Hace casi 30 años estos hombres y yo fundamos este pueblo.
Estamos mamados de que decidan por nosotros.
The trailer for a new big budget Netflix series released today. It is set in South America. It's in Spanish, as you heard, but it's not about the drug cartels. Instead, it's an adaptation of one of the great modern Latin American novels, A Hundred Years of Solitude, a strange and sprawling epic that many thought unfilmable. Indeed, its author, the late Nobel laureate Gabriel García Márquez, never wanted it turned into a movie, or even worse, a Hollywood movie. He thought the format wouldn't do justice to his masterpiece. He died in 2014, and subsequently his sons agreed to allow it to become a series. I've been talking to an expert on the novel for her take. She's Nadia Celis, Professor of Latin American Studies at Bowdoin College in Maine in the US, and host of a podcast, 100 Years of Solitude Together. But first to the series' principal director, the Argentinian filmmaker Alex García López. Was he daunted by the project?
I think my reaction was instant. And then the panic and fear and everything else came much later in the middle of the night. You know, the last thing you kind of want to do is ruin it and get people to sort of feel like you've butchered one of the greatest novels ever written in human history. But I think quickly that fear becomes a motivation. Fear starts to kind of drive you. And then when I spoke to the son of Gabo, he said to me, "I'll give you all my blessing, and don't let the weight of my father's book bring you down."
Nadia Celis, were you a bit nervous about watching this? Because with all great novels that mean a lot to us as individuals, we have our own images, don't we, of what things should look like, what the characters should look like.
Oh, yes, I was very nervous, honestly. But as someone who had been personally touched by the book as a woman growing up in the Caribbean, in the same region that gave place to Macondo, and also as a scholar who has witnessed the way that this book has and continues to be used as almost like a tool to interpret our history and our reality and our identity in the Caribbean, in Colombia, in Latin America. Yes, I was definitely nervous. And, you know, when I first saw the trailer, it was like, oh no, I'm losing something. It was like if somebody was ripping pictures from my own family album. But I'm okay now.
Okay. Alex, I've got to ask you this, because for many people, the book is synonymous with magic realism, and it's become a sort of slightly problematic term and a difficult one to define. But just give our listeners a sense of how did you convey that magic realism, that the sort of reality of life combined with the sort of magic and mystery of this fictional town, Macondo?
First, I had to, like you said, understand what that term meant. Before I arrived in Colombia, which I had never been to before, I worked like for about a year coming up with my vision for the project of this adaptation. And then I go to the Caribbean for the first time in my life, and I realized I had to throw away all my ideas and all my visions out the window, because I suddenly was in front of a Caribbean culture which I knew very little about. And it was my sort of new relationship and discovery with the Caribbean culture where I spent a long time. I was going back and forth for over 6 months and trying to submerge myself in the culture, meeting people, while at the same time kind of reading about Gabo and a lot about his childhood, going to his house, seeing where the place that he grew up with. And Gabo himself said that he tried to tell this story many times and he could never find the angle. He could never sort of find the execution, the approach, until he realized that he needed to tell the 100 Solitude in the same way that his grandmother would tell him these cuentos, these stories.
So when you have things like the famous bag of bones in the house, is it to just do it in a matter-of-fact way, as if it isn't anything particularly
exactly,
remarkable, and yet obviously it is at the same time?
Exactly, and that's because it comes from an ideology of a mixture of cultures. In my humble opinion, it's that sort of, to me, what the term magic realism started mean to me, which is not a genre, it's almost a a culture. It's a way of telling stories for the culture of the Karen, because you have these influences of indigenous tribes, and they obviously have their own beliefs in supernatural, in spirits, in death, in the beyond. So suddenly for them to be telling these stories, you know, Gabo once said, everything that happens in 100 years old, it was based on reality. My grandmother would get really annoyed that every time the electrician would come to the house would get filled up with yellow butterflies. And so the approach to me was just to do it in camera, to not use the visual effects.
Nadia, what did you make of it? Did it work for you?
Yes, it worked for me. I think that the series does reach that sort of like key distinctive element that made Garcia Marquez's magical realism global, because he didn't invent it. But the reason why he in particular was so successful at making it universal is because he created this tone that basically unifies everything that is happening, whatever people have in their minds, the way that they interpret that reality, but also the fantastic and marvelous and legendary elements that he adds to that.
Nadia, what about the way some of the sexual relationships are dealt with? Because I think you're slightly concerned that some of the more problematic and difficult relationships are perhaps not confronted in the most direct way.
That was my big concern. And I think that that's the part where I don't necessarily agree with this interpretation of the novel. I think this is the part where I feel a little disappointment on the missed opportunity to come face to face with some of the problematic aspects in the novel and what they say about the cultural to which this novel is a metaphor. So we see that there is the forced non-consensus violence directly, or even situations as, you know, in the 9-year-old girlfriend of the Coronel Arellano Buendía, that doesn't look like a 9-year-old in the series. Even the very foundational moment at which José Arcadio Buendía, the patriarch, kills his rival, he goes back home and with his weapon threatens Ursula to consent to sex. And in the book, she says, no, you are going to be responsible for this. And in the series, she takes him by the hand and takes him into the bedroom.
Alex, did you decide, or were you asked to tone some of those things down in the series?
No, we weren't asked to tone anything down. You know, we just had to make decisions for better or for worse.
Guys, I just wanted to ask perhaps Nadia just to round things off. Do you think, despite some of the reservations that you've talked about, will this at the very least bring a new generation of viewers to the story, but perhaps also readers to the book?
I hope it brings more readers. I actually think that one of the big strengths of the series is that because of the pace, we get to see the intimate motivations of the characters in a way that in the novel, at the speed of everything that is happening, sometimes we lose that. So I absolutely hope for the series to take the story beyond even the boundaries that already had crossed, and that more readers come back to the book after it.
Nadia Celis, and I was also talking to director of that series, Alex Garcia Lopez. The first 8 episodes out now, but the second tranche of 8 not till next year. That's it for this edition of NewsHour. Thanks for listening. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.